Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm Tom Hall. It's midday at the movies. The voting has begun. Yesterday, members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences started voting on nominations for this year's Academy Awards. Today, Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival weigh in on some late Oscar contenders. Fences is a hit, Silence is making a lot of noise, and Moonlight, which has already won several pre-Oscar awards, is reopening in Baltimore. What were your favorite flicks of 2016? The Midday Monthly Movie Mayhem gets rolling right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. It's the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem with our marvelous movie mayhemists. Anne Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post. Hey, Anne, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. And Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Mr. Dietz, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
There is a statute of limitations. Today is the last day you can say Happy New Year.
Oh. Okay.
On Monday.
Duly noted.
On Monday, you have to start talking about how you're still writing 2016 on your checks. For those of us who write checks. I mean, I write about one check
a year.
What is
the thing of which you speak?
It's, you know. But I'm glad you're here because, you know, I woke up this morning and I looked outside and I saw it was snowing. And I thought, well, we're all going to die. Because that's what you think in Maryland. If you live in Massachusetts or New York, you don't think that.
Right.
But then I saw that the snow is only sticking to the windshields. It wasn't even sticking to the bodies of the car. And it certainly wasn't on the street. It was only sticking to the windshields. So I was overcome with a surge of optimism about the future of the human race. But I also assumed, as I thought I could easily, that midday would start 2 hours late.
Of course.
This is what I assumed, right? Because, I mean, I think we are, by most, you know, reckonings, we are the Hereford zone of radio programs here in Baltimore metropolitan area.
They're never going to live that down.
They start 2 hours late. We should start 2 hours late. So I called Luke Spicknell, our director and engineer. I called him. I said, Luke, I assume we're starting 2 hours late, and I'm sitting there in my PJs. I'm on the family room floor. I'm eating Cheerios. I'm watching Power Rangers. I figure I don't have to come in until 2 o'clock. And he says, no. He says, we're starting at noon. We're starting at noon. He's cracking the whip. So here we are. 7 minutes, 8 minutes afternoon, and we are starting, in fact, our monthly movie mayhem. So thank you for braving the elements today and making it out here. The most depressed I've ever been in a snowstorm that didn't happen is my daughter was in school, in middle school, and her school, which shall remain nameless. I'm driving around. It's a Monday night. It's like 5 o'clock. It's not raining. It's not snowing. There's no precipitation of any kind. And I hear on the radio that her school is canceled for the next day. And I thought, at least they could have the decency to wait until it started snowing to cancel the school.
It is a phenomenon of this region. Coming from Iowa, I can tell you.
You know some snow.
From central New York, same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But thanks for having this cozy fire in the studio for us. It's really great.
In the cocoa.
Unfortunately, the fire wasn't intentional. And we'll be abandoning the studio in about 10 minutes.
Or coughing.
But between now and then, let's talk a little bit. Let's do a little recap of 2016, the year in movies. I mean, let's talk about the business of movies. I mean, they, I guess, had their biggest gross sales ever, Jed?
Well, not ever, but in recent history. The very quick history is movie going peaked in the 40s and then sort of went gradually down to the 60s and has been going sort of gradually up, a little bumpy, but gradually up since then, which is sort of fascinating, a whole other show to be done. But this year was phenomenal. Disney did about 25% of the overall business. Very big hits. Rogue One, of course, still roaring.
The latest Star Wars episode. Right.
But the studios are putting out fewer movies, but the ticket sales are up. People, despite all the internet stuff and movies on all kinds of screens that you carry around every day, including your watch, people are going to movie theaters.
And I mean, this sort of year-to-year calculation of whether we're up or down, mm-hmm. I mean, the gross sales are up. Is it also possible that just because the ticket prices are higher?
Yeah.
That's a part of it. And it's part of, you know, 3D is added to that income. Clearly, international is just becoming more and more important. So I believe I think that although revenue is up, attendance is relatively flat. I mean, actual tushies and seats has remained sort of flat, and that is a cause of concern. And so, as Jed said, they are making fewer movies, but they're really concentrating all their resources on these big tentpole franchisee. Mm-hmm. Things like the Avengers and Star Wars. Warner Brothers is trying to find its footing with the whole DC Comics. I mean, they did relatively well with Batman and Superman and Suicide Squad, but I do think they got dinged by reviewers and also, frankly, by viewers. Mm-hmm. And even the studio will acknowledge that they were not, you know, the quality of those films wasn't really, I think, to anybody's satisfaction, and they probably could have even made more if they'd been better. So everybody is trying to find their way through this business model of tentpole movies and big effects, and but also still making these kinds of, you know, adult-oriented mid-range dramas that I would dare say we and our listeners still want to go see.
What makes a movie like Batman versus Superman mm-hmm. better? I mean, I'm not the type that goes to see those kinds of,
right.
you know, adventure stuff blowing up, people flying through the
right.
air movies. That just happens not to be my thing. But obviously, you know, millions of people around the world do go see those. I mean, what's the difference between a pretty good Batman
right.
Superman movie and a really good Batman Superman movie?
That is a really great question. And that's what I think. I mean, one of the buried within that is the question of when does a form and a genre just become exhausted? And I think that, you know, it might be rewarding to compare the Batman, the newest Batman iteration, with the Avengers, which, for my money, you know, really that franchise has been extremely well executed by Marvel. And
is that the one that has like 6 or 7 heroes in it, or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, and it has sort of, they overlap the universe. It's a shared universe, but the heroes like Iron Man and Thor and Ant Man and. Is Wolverine one of them? No, he's the X-Men. But they can kind of spin off and have their own standalone movies, but then they all come together in these, you know, grand guignols of action mayhem. But I think what makes them so enjoyable is it really comes down to script, mm-hmm. which often really comes down to tone, because, you know, the storylines, let's face it, aren't that original. So really, it's a matter of tone, tonal clarity, tonal balance between humor and lightness.
And character, I would say, too.
Then that gets to casting. And I think that one of the secrets to the Marvel universe is that all of those movies have been extraordinarily well cast. When you get over to the Batman thing, I mean, Batman's now been done by Tim Burton very well, and by Chris Nolan very well, both of whom brought a darkness and mm-hmm. a sophistication to that people really, the audience really had, appreciated. And I feel like we know it can be dark. You know, we know it can be sophisticated. It's time to bring a new color to it, or some kind of new tonal value to it that we haven't already seen. And it just feels like they haven't found it yet.
So, Jed, I mean, the thing about these big studios, obviously some studios are getting it right and others not so right. I mean, Disney's got something right if they're 25% of the market.
Yeah.
But the studios, I mean, these individual directors, the casting directors, the cinematographers, I mean, they're all individual movies, are they not? I mean, are the people running the studios these days as movie people, as visionaries in the genre, are they smarter than they used to be? Are there good folks at the top of the studio? And are they picking the perfect directors, the perfect producers, the perfect everybody's?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is yes when everything works. I mean, there's a lot of luck that goes into it. I mean, I do think Bob Iger's decision to buy the Star Wars franchise.
He's the Disney guy.
He's the head of Disney. And he's a business guy by background. He comes through the financial side, ABC and then Disney. And he's very smart and a very, very good businessman. But that was a decision at the time. People thought he'd way overpaid. The Star Wars franchise was exhausted. You know, how far is it going? And I don't know whether he personally gets credit for managing it the way it's been managed, but that decision to buy it was clearly the right one, and they've managed it beautifully. Force Awakens was a huge hit. Rogue One is a huge hit. And, you know, they've breathed life into this thing. How much longer it can go? I mean, they got one more movie shooting right now, so we know there's going to be one more. And it's, you know, they've just handled it superbly.
But to your point, the directors really do matter. And that's part of this. Because I think when you get a
And the Bob Igers of the world are the ones who decide who directs what movie.
Absolutely. Right. And I think that's – I did a story earlier this year that's the new tourism is intellectual property management, you know. And it counts. I mean, it's like they used to think this was not execution dependent. We've talked about that before. They thought that just, you know, throw a Star Wars movie up on the screen and people will come. And that's true to an extent. But it has to be well executed. It has to be really, really good because they care. You know, viewers still do care about quality. So that's why you get a J.J. Abrams who understands. He understands that world, and he understands.
And which one did he direct?
He did the Force Awakens. Uh-huh. And I think in a way that preserved all of the values that made that series so beloved by generations. So he kind of rescued it and resuscitated it in those ways and then set it up to be pushed forward by a director like Rian Johnson, who is an amazing young filmmaker who did a great science fiction thriller called Looper a few years ago. He's doing the next Star Wars installment, which I think is a really smart choice because I think somebody like him has the taste and the chops and the command of the medium and the fluency to kind of, you know, now let's push it forward and see what it can do. Whereas a Zack Snyder, who did the Batman versus Superman movie, I don't think he's at that level. I just don't think he's as interesting. I don't think his taste is as good.
And that's,
so
I guess, his
movies tend to be more dreary and a little bit more monochromatic and monotone.
Yeah. Okay, and that's the difference between the indie scene and the big blockbuster Hollywood scene, right? So the indie movie makers, the directors and the producers are going to studios and saying, we have this idea, we want you to fund it, please, and distribute it. Whereas Mr. Iger is deciding, okay, we've got this blockbuster franchise that we've just spent all this money on, so now I'm going to spend however many hundreds of millions of dollars on a movie, and I want you or you or you to direct it, and they are controlling it from the very beginning. Right. So yeah, the creative control really is in the hands and minds and eyes of the business folks.
Ultimately, for sure. But I think what Anne's describing is a very important break point where what their big decision is, who's the director and what are the values we're going to have? What are the basic values in the script? What are we looking for? And do we feel from a business standpoint we need very recognizable stars, or do we want to go in the other direction and get great actors who maybe are not so recognizable and help make them into stars? And those decisions are really crucial and have huge artistic impact. And all that, I mean, in this medium, the director is sort of the lever or the prism through which all that happens. So that decision is a huge mm-hmm. thing. And we've seen other franchises, the Harry Potter franchises, in which Warner Brothers chose, again, not obvious directors, artistic directors, independent, brought-up directors, and a screenwriter, Steve Clovis, who wrote all but one of them, who had great credentials, but who knew? That was a gamble to hand him that franchise.
And actor, you know, these unknown actors, and who
completely
knew,
unknown. Right.
You know, like, who knew that they would ever age that gracefully and beautifully? And, I mean, that was such a gamble. But you can see they're doing the same thing.
Daniel, what's his name?
Radcliffe and Emma Watson. Right. And they've done the same thing with Force Awakens and Rogue
yep.
One. You know, I mean, they're not star-driven. These are all relatively – we know them because they all started – most of these actors started in indies. But I think it's a really smart play. I mean, we saw that with Mark Ruffalo playing the Hulk in the Avengers. I mean, we all thought of him as this art house guy who did Kenneth Lonergan movies and the kids are all right. And then, boom, he's the Hulk. And guess what? It matters. You know, it matters that the Hulk is played by a really fine actor. I mean, he brought so much more emotion and expression to that characterization than anybody else could have done.
Anne Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the great movies that are in theaters these days and hear from you with your questions, comments, and suggestions for great flicks that you have seen this year. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @Midday. Tom Hall. What have you seen that you think everybody else should see? Particularly, think about movies that you saw early in the year, like January, February of 2016. Have we forgotten those now that we're getting towards Oscar time and we're concentrating on the movies that have come out late in the year? More when we come back. Stay with us.
I should have expected to find you holding Vader's leash. I recognized your foul stench when I was brought on board.
Charming to the last. You don't know how hard I found it signing the order to terminate your life.
I'm surprised you had the courage to take the responsibility yourself.
Princess Leia, before your execution, I would like you to be my guest at a ceremony that will make this battle station operational. No star system will dare oppose the Emperor now.
The more you tighten your grip, Tarkin, the more star systems will slip through your fingers.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Midday, the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem. That's Princess Leia, of course, who will forever and forever be linked to Carrie Fisher, who passed away a few weeks ago, along with her mother, Debbie Reynolds. Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post joins us. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival joins us. I'm Tom Hall. You know, Anne, you wrote a beautiful tribute or an essay about Carrie Fisher, whom you talked to at the Cannes Film Festival. You also wrote a really great essay about the new kinds of movie stars that we have now. You mentioned in particular Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. Mm-hmm. Carrie Fisher was the old kind of movie star, wasn't she, in a lot of ways? I mean, sort of a traditional, but a very... A very unique sui generis figure, because acting was just one of many things that she did really well.
Yeah, and it was one of those things when you're at a film festival like Cannes, you get these off the cuff offers, like, hey, you know, do you want to go spend 20 minutes with Carrie Fisher? You know, it's all very improv and ad hoc. And when someone asks if you want to spend 20 minutes with Carrie Fisher, that is a yes, because I had never met her before, and I've always admired her from afar, both as an actress and mostly as a writer. I will never forget reading Postcards from the Edge when it first came out and being just astonished at what a brilliant, brilliant mind she was. So I had this delightful 20 minutes with Carrie and Gary, her French bulldog, you know, and constant companion. They sat and they shared a dish of vanilla ice cream, and it was like meeting an old friend. And I'm sure everybody thinks of her this way. I mean, she was so unfailingly honest and candid and available. And what I gathered in our conversation, in our very brief conversation, you know, she's done this documentary called Bright Lights, about her mom and about her mother, especially her mom's late-in-life performing career, because Debbie Reynolds, I mean, if she could run, jump, or hop, she would play. You know, she would play nightclubs.
She was a hoofer and a singer.
And Carrie was sort of, you know, she expressed to me how sort of that always, it inspired her, and she was happy her mom had that because it obviously kept her going on one level, but she also felt like it sapped something from her as well. And she was a little bit, I thought, bemused by that compulsion to perform, and clearly Carrie Fisher didn't have that. She was not bitten by that bug. I mean, she was good at it, and I think it's interesting that both of them became stars at 19 in these movies that went on to become phenomena, one being Singin' in the Rain for Debbie and then Star Wars for Carrie Fisher. Had it not been for that, I didn't get from her the vibe that she just had to sing and dance and play and be in front of the camera
all the
time.
Although she did a one-woman show.
Clearly, but she was
so... I saw that at the Hippodrome. It was delightful.
Oh, she's wonderful, but I just don't... I didn't get the compulsion part from her at all. She's very happy writing. She's very happy observing life. And she was just delightful, fun to be with. And one last little note, I mean... She was just as forthcoming about mental illness and her management of that, of her bipolar diagnosis. Yeah, but I mean, our conversation really centered more around the mental illness piece, which has been her, you know, addiction was a part of her earlier life.
Right.
But that was just so hugely important, especially to young people. And she told me the story of a 14-year-old boy who she met after one of her shows, who said, you know, he had just gotten this diagnosis of being bipolar, and his mom said, you know, Princess Leia is bipolar, and it just made all the difference to him, and it made all the difference to her when she met him, and that That was her.
And this documentary, Jed, is going to be on HBO tomorrow night.
Yeah, tomorrow night. They moved it up because of the deaths of both Carrie and her mom. Somebody tweeted right after Carrie died, from who knew her very well, said, you can sum it up because when Postcards from an Edge...
And that was a novel that was a sort of thinly described or thinly veiled autobiography.
And about her relationship with her mom. And said, you know, when somebody chooses Meryl Streep to play you in a movie, you've had a pretty good life. Mm. And I would add on Debbie Reynolds' death and when Shirley MacLaine plays you in the same movie, that says something about both of you.
Mm. Yeah. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Hornaday from the Washington Post. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking movies today. What are your favorite flicks that you've seen recently? 410-662-8780 is where you can call us. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address and our Twitter handle at midday Tom Hall. So yesterday, folks in the Academy began voting on who they'd like to see nominated for the Academy Awards. We'll find out the list of nominations at the end of the month, and then the end of next month, we'll, of course, have the Academy Awards. So next month on the Movie Mayhem, we'll talk about your prognostications for who's going to win. But there are, it's almost inescapable that stuff that comes out late in the year are the things that you think about for the Academy Awards rather than the things that came out earlier. You know, like Fences was released on Christmas Day, mm-hmm. the 25th of December, you know, and I think Silence was released 2 days earlier. So, I mean, these are all, you know, that's the Scorsese movie and Fences, of course, the Denzel Washington movie. But it matters, doesn't it, the timing of that. Does that mean, Jed, then, that the movies that studios are releasing in January and February are movies that they just don't think have a chance? Is it, or I mean, if they call up you, if you're the producer of the movie, they call you up and say, good news, your release date is February 2nd. Did the people like go into the fetal position and cry?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the correlation statistically over the years between the movies that have done well in awards season and the time of year, third and fourth quarter release, is, you know, inescapable. So yes, this is a, once you get past the Christmas releases, there's a bit of a lull, but some surprises in there too. I mean, over the years, but that's exactly right. I mean,
but so there have been some good, you know.
There have been some wonderful movies.
Can you think back to earlier in 2016?
Yes.
Some of those. What are some of the movies that strike you that should be Oscar contenders that may or may not be when we find out the end of this month?
I'll throw out two. One I know is a long shot, but it's one that I will go to my grave defending. Poor old Hail Caesar, the comedy from the Coen brothers, the 1950s Hollywood comedy with George Clooney as an actor starring in a Swords and Sandals Bible epic. It was so funny, so smart, and really so touching. Clooney played the movie star, and then Josh Brolin played a studio executive who's having a moment of sort of a crisis of faith in terms of his devotion to the movie business and whether it's just too superficial and crazy and silly and he should do something else. And it really, for all of its farce and satire of which, it's just a Valentine to those 50s genres. There's a musical number like an Esther Williams number with Scarlett Johansson, and then there's a hilarious bit with Ralph Fiennes and Alden Ehrenreich in a kind of sophisticated parlor comedy. But it really is about faith and about vocation, and I found it to be actually quite profound and really
Hail
genuine.
Caesar. Hail Caesar, the dark horse. Yeah,
okay, that's one. That came out, I think, in January or February. And then in March, we had a really wonderful political thriller called Eye in the Sky with Helen Mirren and the late Alan
Rickman. About the drones.
About the drones. A really well-written, well-crafted, well-acted, just a straight-ahead good movie, which I strongly recommend if people haven't seen it yet.
Jed, anything come to mind about early releases in 2016 that shouldn't be forgot as the Academy members are?
I
remember you really liked that movie, Hell or High Water.
Yes, not January or February, but I loved that movie.
I mean, it was at the summer. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But that was like a Western thing or something.
Yeah.
I never saw it.
Tyler Sheridan, the guy who wrote Sicario, wrote this one, and I think it's the best script of the year. I mean, it's... and we'll see if it gets any recognition, but might not because of release schedule. A great performance by Jeff Bridges that could get nominated, or every part of it I thought really worked.
Yeah.
Contemporary Western, really funny and
Beautifully acted.
So we'll see. 410-662-8780 is the number to call to get involved in our conversation here about movies on Midday. Midday@WIPR.org is our email address. At Midday Tom Hall is the Twitter handle. Ken in Ellicott City, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday.
Thank you, Tom.
Hi, Ken.
Hi there. Yeah, I wanted to speak up for Florence Foster Jenkins and Captain Fantastic with Viggo Mortensen.
Excellent.
Yeah, both very, very strong movies and were very well received. I mean, Florence Foster Jenkins was even, wasn't it sort of revamped and re-released?
Yes, it just came back out. And Hugh Grant, I thought, was wonderful in it.
Yeah, I don't think I stopped smiling the whole movie. That was a wonderful experience. But also, I think Viggo Mortensen has been overlooked. He's been nominated many times for many things, but I don't know if he'll get Best Actor. But I just thought he was great. And the young girl, all the kids were great, but the young girl was amazing.
I agree, Ken. I thought he was absolutely... You know, this is one of the reasons... The Golden Globes are Sunday night, and one of the reasons I like the Golden Globes is that they make room for these, for comedies, and it allows... And they've nominated both these films, I believe. And I think Viggo is nominated for comedy.
So Captain Fantastic is considered a comedy?
Yeah, and it was. I mean, it was.
Well, it was a great mix. The script has to get awarded for something. That's just an amazing script. I haven't heard words like that for a long time in a movie.
I agree with you, Ken.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say that I thought Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher in New York in 1974 for a while, which was kind of odd.
Oh, that's fun. Was that nice? Did you ever borrow a cup of sugar or a quart of milk?
We never got to speak to them. But in October, this was 1974, and in October they put up a big tent in the Secret Gardens, in Turtle Bay Gardens behind. And I'm wondering if it might have been Carrie's 19th birthday, because the two of them were on Broadway at the time.
Huh.
And we had Katharine Hepburn on one side and Debbie Reynolds on the other. We were living in the house of Garson Kanin and his wife.
Oh, my goodness.
Fantastic.
When are you writing your book?
Well, I've written a story with pictures. It's rather amusing. I might send it to you, Anne.
I love it, Ken.
All right. Ken, the author of the upcoming tell-all expose. Well, thanks for your call, Ken. I appreciate it. Happy New Year. Phil in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Anne Hornaday and Jed Dietz.
Oh, good afternoon and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'd like to mention earlier this year the movie Race, which was a story of the Olympic champion Jesse Owens, the star of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, which I saw. And it was reasonably good, although there were some historical inaccuracies in it. I'm a very big fan of the Olympics, and I met Jesse Owens in person once here in Baltimore in 1978, 2 years before he died. So I was glad to see that made into a movie. Though I think it would have been better maybe if it came out somewhat in the second half of the year, maybe after the Rio Olympics took place, and then there'd be more of an interest.
Because
people had Olympics on the mind. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that movie. I missed that one completely. You guys, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Yeah.
And that was starring the wonderful Chadwick Boseman, a Howard University grad, who's sort of our generation's answer to Paul Mooney. I mean, he played Jackie Robinson. He played
James Brown.
He did a fantastic job in the James Brown movie. And Jesse Owens, and I think he just signed on to, I can't remember what movie, but he's doing another biopic, so he's really found his niche, and he's a terrific actor.
Yeah,
he's a
really good actor.
He's Judy Garland. He'll find every historical figure.
Right, or Paul Mooney, right.
And he'll sing them all and stay here all night. Let's listen to a little clip about a movie that's gotten tremendous buzz, acclaim, critical acclaim, and it sounds like it's doing pretty good. This is the new Denzel Washington treatment of the August Wilson play Fences. Here's a little clip.
How come you ain't never like me?
What law is there say I got to like you?
None.
All right, then. Don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
As long as you in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day.
Yes, sir.
Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
Got clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me. But why do you think that is?
Because you like me?
Oops.
Strong stuff. Strong stuff. I mean, Denzel, everyone says Denzel Washington is amazing in this movie. And Jed, he not only acts in it, but he directs it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. It started as a popular play. This has been, people have tried to make this movie for many years. Eddie Murphy was supposed to originally star, he was a major star at the time, as the kid. So back when he could have played a kid. And August Wilson, who's been dead for a while, had written the screenplay. And there was a real resistance, probably because of race, but also largely because of taking a play and moving it to the screen. And I think,
yeah, because the history of taking serious dramatic theatrical things and putting them in the movies isn't great. I mean, musicals are one thing, but the serious dramas, that's not so much.
Huh? Not so much. And this was a very interior play about this family. On stage took place in this backyard where he was planning to build this fence. The father, the Denzel, in this case, the Denzel Washington character, played by James Earl Jones on Broadway. And he was building this fence, and the whole thing takes place in this backyard. That's what you're looking at from your seat. And Denzel has opened it up with August Wilson's help, because he was working with the August Wilson screenplay in a way that really works, I think. And the power of this interior life of this struggling but middle-class family in Pittsburgh, and the dynamic between the husband and the wife, and the husband and the wife and their son, is a very powerful thing, and it's translated to the screen beautifully, and it's doing well, really pleasing studios.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm going to see it tomorrow afternoon. We have a double date and everything. We're going to see dinner and a movie with friends. It's going to be great. It's going to be just like grown-ups. It's going to be terrific. Anne, first of all, the marketing for this movie seems very interesting and pretty massive. I opened up the New York Times paper version of the New York Times last month, and there was an 8-page insert that was all about fences. Gigantic full-page picture of Mr. Washington, a gigantic full-page picture of Viola Davis. I mean, they were really going at it big time. Now, perhaps a New York Times, the people who are old and reading the New York Times in a paper version are exactly the audience.
And theater fans.
In an August Wilson play. So they have pushed it. So they clearly believed in this movie. And it sounds like they had every reason to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been superbly made. And it reprises Washington and Davis's performance of this in the Broadway revival. Mm-hmm. So they obviously know the material inside out, and I agree with Jed. I think it's opened up just enough, but it isn't opened up too much. You know, I think he keeps it really tightly focused. And generally, you would call something like that stagey, you know, or too constricted. But it completely works for this character who is practically bursting through these constrictions. You know, these geographical and social and historical constrictions that have really hemmed him in. It's just a ferocious performance, both by Washington and by Viola Davis, and it's a wonderful experience.
We're getting a correction, I guess. Yes. Mr. Google has called.
Sorry,
Chadwick Boseman was not actually in Race; it was Stephen James.
My apologies.
Who played John Lewis in Selma?
Oh, that's exactly right. Well,
good
well played,
correction.
Sir.
Thanks.
And yes. Both terrific actors.
Both terrific actors. All right. Well,
thank
we
you.
Will have more terrific conversation when we come back. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, in a new book, the economist and demographer Nicholas Eberstadt describes what he labels a quiet catastrophe. Since 1965, the rate of men who are employed and participating in the economy has declined steadily. More than 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 54 are not working and not even looking for work. So coming up on Midday Monday, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. So if you've just joined us now, it's the monthly movie mayhem here on Midday. Our cinematic scholars Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, join me here in Studio A. You can join us when we come back from a quick break, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We'll see you in 90 seconds. And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem, along with Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. We're talking movies. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Michael in Baltimore, Happy New Year, and welcome to Midday.
Thanks. Happy New Year to you, too. Really enjoying the conversation, and wanted to just point out an excellent film that I think got very much overlooked this year, Moonlight. I can't tell you the director, but the
Barry
acting
Jenkins
was superb, and it was one of the few films this year and recent history, really, that highlighted the complexities of being a black male in any other minority community as well, like the LGBT community or disabled community or anything like that. So it was great to see a film like that this year.
Well, thank you for your call, Michael. You get complete agreement for the three of us at this table, and I think we probably would disagree with your assessment that it was overlooked, because it racked up a bunch of awards at the Gotham Independent Awards, mm-hmm. which were sort of the first ones. It did very well at the Critics Circle, the National Board of Review. It was sort of Moonlight, Manchester by the Sea, and La La Land were the mm-hmm. big ones, I guess, in those things. The Golden Globes is on Sunday. We'll see how it does, but there's expectations that it will do well, mm-hmm. and it will also be a big Oscar contender. And Jed, they're actually re-releasing this movie. I mean, it's back at the Charles Theater, I think, in Baltimore, this weekend.
Right? Yeah, it reopens today, so you have another chance to see it. And it's a movie that you should see on the big screen. I mean, I feel that about every movie, but this is especially important. And he's exactly right. You know, it takes us into a very specific part of our culture, Liberty City, Miami, it communicates in a way that movies at their best and art at its best does. And the acting is superb. Barry Jenkins' first film was at the Festival of Medicine for Melancholy several years ago. And Michael's right. I think that when it came out, everybody thought, well, maybe this is a little, it'll be worthy, but it's a little tiny art movie. And it clearly has real crossover potential. And there's a real, it's a tough area to be in through the movie, and this incredible ray of hope that I think is right for our time, too, as you get toward the end. It's a great movie.
And because Anne Hornaday, because of the buzz of the movie, because it was so critically acclaimed, because it has won some of these other early awards, the members of the Academy who are voting as to what movie should be nominated, they're doing that now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the voting opened yesterday, and it closes next week, I think. That will influence. I mean, last year, the year before, we had Oscars So White. You know, there was mm-hmm. a whole incredible dearth of actors and directors and of color represented in the nominations. We'll talk about this more next month when we really zero in on the Oscars. But it sounds like Moonlight could be one of the examples where that's not going to be the case this year.
Definitely. And it does matter. I mean, like, that's why these awards, you know, the Gothams and the all those Critics Circle awards that you mentioned, and even the Golden Globes, I mean, it puts these titles and these movies on their radar, the 6,000 Academy members who are going to be nominating. And everybody's nominating within their own craft. So the writers are going to be nominating Best Screenplay, and the actors are going to be nominating Best Actor, and then the whole Academy votes on the winners. But I think any and all awareness. And then not only is this sort of putting these movies on their radar, but it's putting movies on mm-hmm. our radar. So mm-hmm. it's kind of it's become, like we were talking earlier about that tentpole movie model. This is the model for the rest of the movies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
For the rest
the
of
the other
us,
movies, right?
That, like Michael said, it might seem to him that it's getting overlooked because Star Wars is so huge and there are other bigger movies. But really, in terms of targeting awareness with the people that are likely to see it, it's the awareness is really pretty high, I would think.
I think you're right. I would add, you're too modest to say so, but I would say the critical community had a great hand in this too. But it's a small distributor without a huge, they can't do 8-page spreads in the New York Times.
Sure.
Who
can?
The studios
big studios, yeah.
And so this is, and it's so great to be talking about this right after Fences, because they are coming from very, very different places in the business. And yet I think they've both occupied are really grabbing people's attention in a way that surprised, in one case, a studio, in one case, a smaller distributor who loved the film but didn't know it could play like this.
Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post. It's Midday and the Monthly Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall. Let's listen to a clip, you guys, from another movie that sounds delightful. I can't wait to see it, called Hidden Figures. Mm. This is the story of a team of African-American women who worked at NASA back in the day. They were like mathematical geniuses. Without them, we would not have been able to launch our first successful space mission. So this is the beginning of NASA from Hidden Figures.
I will have you know, I was the first Negro female student at West Virginia University Graduate School. On any given day, I analyze the manometer levels for air displacement, friction, and velocity, and compute over 10,000 calculations by hand. So yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts. It's because we wear glasses.
What a great line. It's not because wonderful? We wear skirts, it's because we wear glasses. Gotta love it.
Oh, I just love this movie. It opened a few weeks ago in just a handful of theaters, and today it goes wide, and I'm so excited that the rest of the country gets to see it. It's a really special movie. We just heard Taraji P. Henson. She co-stars with Octavia Spencer. Janelle Monáe, who made a breakout debut in Moonlight, mm-hmm. as it happens, but here really takes the stage in a much more meaty role and is absolutely incandescent. It's just enormous fun to watch. It's an extraordinary story that I certainly hadn't heard before.
Nobody had. I think that's what's so great.
A few people had.
It's
but,
a novel, or not
based,
a novel.
Yeah,
it's
based
it's
on a book. Yeah.
You know, a nonfiction book.
Somebody had
book,
written about it, but still, I can't say enough about it. It's just delightful, and it's one of those few movies that I can honestly say take the whole family to. I mean, it's appropriate for pretty much any age group, young and old. I mean, it's just a terrific general audience, uplifting, wonderful movie.
Yeah, good for them.
And great characters. And I think these women, and I didn't know anything about this as part of the early space program and the Mercury program, and how important they were for specific things like John Glenn's orbit would not have happened without the calculations done by these women.
His launch and landing were both calculated by Henson's character.
Yeah, doing hand calculations. You see in the movie.
The pre-computer.
They were called computers. The women were called computers. But you see in the movie one of these huge, monstrous computers that, of course, doesn't quite work right as these women are doing the calculations. And with men around them skeptical, and even more so with the African-American women were really separated. So it's this time of our history. You think, how do all these pieces fit together? And great to be reminded of how this diversity can get things done.
And you know, it's a fascinating bookend with Loving, which we talked about, I think, a week or two ago. It's roughly
That's
the same
time period. The
biracial
couple that had the big court case in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and it's roughly the same time period. And I think in similar ways, it makes points about the kind of, you know, in Loving, we saw kind of the pathology of racism, not because the filmmaker wanted to underline it or, you know, felt the need to underscore it. It was just so obvious by the way he told the story in terms of these people's marriage. And by the same token, in this one, you see the waste. Just the waste of intelligence that these biases create. Yeah.
Ann Hornaday from The Washington Post, Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival. It's midday, 410-662-8780 is our phone number, midday@wypr.org. If you want to send us an email, and @MiddayTomHall is our Twitter handle. John in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. A Man Called Uwe.
That's a foreign film, I guess. A Man Called Uwe. What's it about, John?
Swedish. A grumpy old man loses his wife. It's just a Grinch. And the gradual coming around to new neighbors and his surroundings. It's been nominated Academy Award, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's on the short list, yeah.
Yeah. It's also really funny. I mean, it has this sort of dark humor base. And it's very skillfully done because he is a Grinch, as John said. But you start to, as the onion layers are peeled back, you see what caused this. And it's one of these really wonderfully entertaining and quite emotional movies along with the humor.
Good suggestion. Yeah. A Wonderful Man film. Called Uwe. Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Speaking of Grinches, I don't know if I'm exactly characterizing him correctly, but there's a new movie about a bus driver played by Adam Driver called Patterson. And is he kind of
Grinchy?
He's not a
Grinch. No, he's the
I thought he was kind of grumpy.
No, he's
Mr.
No.
Nice Guy? Okay. Then I've got it wrong. I've got it wrong.
He's quiet.
That's not the first time.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm looking at you to see if it's a good movie or not.
It's a wonderful movie.
Because I must tell you, this is a horrible thing. My wife, whom I love dearly, Linnell, she's heard from somebody.
Okay.
I don't know.
Who shall go nameless.
It has to go nameless because I'm not even sure she remembers. That's a bad movie. It was boring. It was long. So, and that's the kind of thing. People spread these rumors. Do you want to go see Patterson? No, because I heard it wasn't very good. So it's, you know, the poor people who make these movies, they're just subjected to this. So you're telling me, film critic for The Washington Post, Patterson's a good movie.
I gave it 4 stars in my review today. I just adore this movie. It's from Jim Jarmusch, who people might remember from movies like Strangers in Paradise and Down by Law, and more recently like Broken Flowers and
Coffee and Cigarettes,
and the vampire movie with Tilda Swinton and right. Tom Hiddleston. I can't remember what it was called, but anyway, it is just the most
Love Letters. Is that what it's called?
No, I don't think so.
Love.
Only Lovers Left Alive.
That's it. Only Lovers.
And you know, it's interesting.
You guys would be fun to play charades with.
And that one, here's my segue for that. That took place, the Tilda Swinton vampire movie took place in Detroit, which was a real love letter to the kind of living ruin of Detroit in this kind of post-industrial landscape. And he's taken that same eye to Paterson, New Jersey, and filmed the city with such loving tenderness and lyrical beauty.
It's really extraordinarily beautiful.
Really beautiful. I mean, just visually beautiful. And it's about this bus driver played by Adam Driver, his name is Paterson, who is a poet. And he lives with his wife in a little house with their bulldog. And he has a routine where every day he gets up and he goes to work and he drives the bus and he looks at his city and he listens to his writers and he composes poems in his head. And the poems are written out on the screen and they are tender and beautiful and that is his life, and she also has a creative life that's a little bit wackier and a little bit more scattered. But it's really about these two people kind of protecting one another's creative lives and inner lives and supporting each other. And it's just
and Adam Driver, I saw him first, I guess, on Girls, right?
He's yeah,
in that. And then now he's a movie star.
Yeah, he was in Star Wars last year in The Force Awakens. I mean, he's in Silence, the new Scorsese film. The other thing I would say about this movie, Jim Jarmusch is an artist of the highest order and had, you know, has loved by many people in the film world, but has never had huge commercial success. And I don't, you know, maybe not every movie he makes is for everybody, but everything Anne said is right. I think the love note for Paterson and for this kind of in a completely non-patronizing way, this assertion that yes, a bus driver can be a great poet and have deep artistic instinct is, again, something to be. It's true, and it's great to see this expressed in film in a way that's believable. The other thing I would say is there are little visual notes all through the movie. Twins show up in a variety of ways that is really fun, and this house he lives in is a duplicate of the house that the band occupied for The Big Pink. And and I think all of this very purposeful in Jim, but very slyly put into the film. So for the right person, it's wonderful.
Yeah, there are all these little homages. Of course, Paterson was the birthplace of Allen Ginsberg. So there are these little and William Carlos Williams, another working man, you know, poet, wrote about Paterson. So there are all these wonderful little homages to the people that have come, you know, Lou Costello and Hurricane Carter. And I mean, the whole city's history and its cultural life are given their due in this just absolutely beautiful film.
All right, Paterson with Adam Driver. It's at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore. Well, Ann, Jed, always good to see you. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
No, thanks for having us.
Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. They'll be moving into their new digs at the Parkway Theater in the spring. We've got a link to information about the film festival and a link to Ann's reviews in the Post on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday on Midday, Nicholas Eberstadt on his latest book exploring what he calls the invisible crisis of the nearly 7 million men who aren't working in their prime working years. The economists Anibon Barsu and Julianne Malveaux will also join us for that conversation. I hope you can join us too Monday coming up on Midday. Midday is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Charlie Hines and Zandra Ellen provide production assistance. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls, your tweets, your emails. Thanks for subscribing to the Midday podcast. I look forward to being with you next week. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.